Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our weekly podcast on constitutional law. This is Jenny, back with you to talk more this week about federalism and the powers of the federal or national government. Please go ahead and open up the slides, the week 11 slides, so you're going to find that on Canvas on the week 11 roadmap. And once you get those open and navigated to our second slide, you will see listed there the objectives we have for this episode. We're going to continue diving into federalism and how we divide powers between different levels of government, with our focus this time on national government. What does the national level get to take power over, or what has kind of been clearly designated as within their realm? Now, tied very much directly to this are a few specific clauses in the Constitution. We're going to emphasize the Commerce Clause, the power of taxation, and the power of spending. Now, they're not exactly all clauses per se, but they are powers that are enumerated or listed in the Constitution. And then to wrap up, we're going to talk a little bit, or very briefly, that is, about five cases related to the powers of the federal government. The last one being a very recent case, Trump v. Anderson, and what is the power of the states versus the federal government when it comes to the 14th Amendment? All right, let's move right into these slides. When we look at the enumerated powers on slide 3, on the left-hand side, you can see things like coin money or regulate interstate and foreign commerce. That regulate interstate and foreign commerce is its own version of a clause called the Commerce Clause. Pretty vague, not unlike what is listed below it, the Conduct Foreign Affairs. So you'll remember a little bit about the war and foreign affairs conversation. What exactly does foreign affairs mean? We have to provide some clarification around that language. So let's get into what the Commerce Clause language is, and then let's push on to how has the Supreme Court really tried to clarify this? The Commerce Clause is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3. The Congress shall have power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. That is the formal direct language from the Constitution. There are a few terms here that are, well, needing more explanation. That term, there's really just one. It's commerce. What is commerce? We can say that it means a certain thing. We can go with a textbook definition, but we're going to need to lay that out very much more in detail to establish constitutional boundaries around that term. To be pretty direct and honest, the Supreme Court's really struggled with this. Establishing what the Commerce Clause means or what qualifies as commerce is really difficult, and we have a long, long legacy of cases that are trying to draw some pretty definitive lines and struggling to continue with those lines as we move forward over time. So the questions that the Supreme Court has put forth about the Commerce Clause to clarify what commerce means. Number one, what activities constitute commerce? Are we talking about trade specifically, where an item needs to cross state lines or a boundary of some form? Are we talking about production, which is just the creation of the item? Does production qualify as commerce? And what about when production maybe doesn't cross state lines? Is that still commerce? Because it could affect the market? Difficult question. And followed by another difficult question. Let's talk about the division. If the power to regulate commerce is divided between the national and state levels, what are the activities that Congress specifically can regulate? If we go back to the language of the Commerce Clause itself, it says that Congress has the power to regulate commerce among the several states, which has generally meant when there is trade across state lines. Now, that also means that there's a space here for state governments to regulate commerce within state lines. So this is the difference between interstate, I-N-T-E-R, and intrastate, I-N-T-R-A. Those are particularly important boundaries because what the Supreme Court recognized is, yeah, states do have power in this realm. They do have power with respect to commerce and trade. So how are we going to divvy this up, right? We can't say Congress has the right to oversee everything. That would be, frankly, unreasonable and unmanageable. So where do we draw the line again? And then the last element, the last kind of question that the Commerce Clause has created or been thrown out there, at least with respect to the Supreme Court and the cases it's seen, is what are the reasons Congress can use as far as regulating these activities? And that goes back to the point here about purpose. For what purposes can Congress regulate commerce? Can it get involved in trade if it's really trying to deal with something with criminal law? Or maybe specific social conditions? Or does it have to be more economically inclined? At this point, we probably need to dig into a few cases in each of these respective question areas to get more of a sense of at least the early development and early case law on the Commerce Clause. And one of the first of these is Gibbons v. Ogden. You'll see this on slide 7. This is going all the way back to 1824. And what happens in Gibbons v. Ogden is you have some shipping lanes and basically navigation between the states of New Jersey and New York. So clearly we're involving multiple states here. And there is a conflict between the two parties in this case. Aaron Ogden and Thomas Gibbons are dealing with a steamship situation, and they form a partnership, and the partnership falls apart, and they end up taking the case to New York courts, which is a question of really where does this belong, because if this trade is taking place across state lines between New Jersey and New York, where do we go? Is this supposed to be something that the New York courts take, or we go to the federal courts? And the New York state court said, this is a U.S. Congress thing. You really can't bring it under state law or to state courts. You got to go the federal route. And so the question that comes up there then is, well, is the Commerce Clause giving Congress authority over interstate navigation? They frame it as navigation because we're talking not necessarily about the specific goods on a boat, but navigation of these trade routes, which, again, it's implicated in commerce, but it's not exactly directly that kind of thing. So in Gibbons v. Ogden, what you see on slide 7 is some of the language that gets pulled from the decision. The Constitution contains an enumeration of powers expressly granted by the people to their government. It has been said that those powers ought to be construed strictly. But why ought they be to be so construed? Is there one sentence in the Constitution which gives countenance to this rule? Now that language is Justice Marshall jumping in to say, well, we don't need to be so textualist in our approach. There are definitely elements here that we could go with textualism, but do we really have to be so nitpicky about the exact wording in this case, right? What he says then on the Commerce Clause is that commerce undoubtedly is traffic, or we could assume here navigation, but it is something more. It is intercourse. Yes, that word, not exactly the word we'd apply to trade today, but that's the language used in the decision. Going on, it describes the commercial intercourse between nations and parts of nations in all its branches, and is regulated by prescribing rules for carrying on that intercourse. What is this power? It is the power to regulate, that is, to prescribe the rule by which commerce is to be governed. Marshall is just so fabulous with the vagaries of language, but really what he's getting at here is, yes, interstate commerce does fall to Congress. It's pretty much under there. And navigation, if we think of commerce as a broad term, definitely falls under this umbrella. So again, bringing it back to what's the language, how do we define the term? Marshall is being not super like hardcore textualist when he says that the words ought to be construed strictly. He's saying, do we have to go with like the most narrow explanation of a term? No, we don't. We could be textualists and we could use broad language or broad understandings of a term, and commerce can absolutely include the notion of navigation. Taking what Marshall has said here about activities, then we can think of commerce as being really broad, right? The language here could include a lot of things. So maybe we can figure out a little bit more clearly what the line is between national and state by looking at, well, the division between national and state. What do we call interstate versus what do we call intrastate? And the classic case that's brought up in your textbook related to this is United States versus E.C. Knight Company from 1895. So we are in the post-Marshall era, in 1895. And United States versus E.C. Knight is all about this general concept of dual federalism, or that at least comes up in the decision. The case facts in United States versus E.C. Knight revolve around the Sherman Antitrust Act. So this gets passed in 1890 because the public is worried about these giant corporations controlling transportation and different realms of industry. I mean, they just have so much power. Not unlike perhaps what we think of today with entities like Amazon or Microsoft, right? These huge corporations, companies that have a lot of reach and a lot of ability to control or assert power in many situations. So this Sherman Antitrust Act comes through in 1890. It's intended to stop these huge conglomerations of power. We want to stop concentrating wealth in, you know, just a few individuals. We want to stop concentrating power in those same individuals. You can't go ahead and monopolize if it's gonna create that kind of concentration. So the E.C. Knight Company here is controlling 98% at this time of sugar refining business throughout the United States. 98% is, yeah, that's a monopoly, right? But they're going to push back on this because they're going to say this isn't illegal. We have existed this way, or we were in existence this way. Why shouldn't we be able to have this kind of power? And they're going to say Congress went beyond what it's allowed to do. This antitrust thing isn't commerce. So when the court gets it, they are going to be considering whether the Antitrust Act is constitutional. And they say that it is. But here's where we get into a weird definitional kind of thing, right? First, we're going to talk about differences between parts of the process. Manufacturing versus maybe distribution. Yes, that sounds very much drug-related, but that is what we're talking about here. The act is constitutional according to the Supreme Court, but they're going to focus on this manufacturing component, right? Before we get to the point about manufacturing, they're going to bring up this concept of dual federalism. Dual federalism meaning that we have powers at the national level and powers at the state level. And the quote from the case is this: "It is vital that the independence of the commercial power and of the police power should always be recognized and observed. For while the one furnishes the strongest bond of union, the other is essential to the preservation of the autonomy of the states as required by our dual form of government." So right off the bat, the court is saying we're going to recognize there is power and authority with the states with respect to commerce, just as there's power and authority with respect to the national government. So we move on to considering the particulars of the E.C. Knight Company, and the court doesn't dive super deep in any case to exactly the case facts. They're trying to come up generally with rules that apply across many cases. And here they say, the fact that an article is manufactured for export due to another state does not of itself make it an article of interstate commerce. And the intent of the manufacturer does not determine the time when the article or product passes from the control of the state and belongs to commerce. Translation here: just because something might be intended for interstate commerce doesn't mean it goes right away under the authority of Congress. So this Antitrust Act, yeah, it might apply to commerce, it might be constitutional, but you can apply it with respect to the notion of manufacturing, right? And manufacturing is what E.C. Knight Company is doing via sugar refining. It's manufacturing sugar by refining the cane, okay? It's a little bit complicated here, but because this sugar was being manufactured in just one state. We don't call it interstate commerce. The Sherman Antitrust Act can stand, but it's not going to apply in this context, okay? The trust that exists with EC Knight does not lead to control of interstate commerce. It only affects it incidentally and indirectly. Boy, though, this is going to create some confusion. It does for me, because if you're making something for interstate commerce and it's going to affect interstate commerce, why wouldn't that be something that can then qualify under congressional authority? Well, we have some problems here. Dual federalism is problematic to apply, as you can see with the questions on slide 10. Are we going to draw the line at selling or trade, or are we going to look at, you know, production and commerce? Are those two different things? Where do we separate those out? Do we have to worry about there being a direct effect on interstate commerce or an indirect effect on interstate commerce? What are we even talking about with an indirect effect? And then we have to get even further into that effect rabbit hole. Is the effect very proximate to what's happening? How big is the effect? Oh, these are just absolutely unworkable questions in the long term. So between 1888 and 1936, the Supreme Court is trying to apply these questions to come up with clear distinction of where Congress has power and where the states have power. And there's just no clear distinction. This isn't workable in the long run, right? So eventually we're going to transition to adding a third question, but they're going to walk away from all of this eventually because this is such a mess. You can't have so many different divisions and lines when commerce perhaps doesn't so clearly match up to the process that the Supreme Court is talking about. So one of the last cases we're going to talk about here has to do with the realm of purpose. And this is not so much about commerce. It's really about child labor. So Hammer versus Dagenhart is a case that is argued in 1918. What's going on with child labor in this era is, well, first of all, child labor was very much utilized in the 1800s. And we get into the beginning of the 1900s, and there is more and more recognition of the dangers of the kinds of jobs these kids are working. In the year 1910, we actually have most of the states in the United States with laws at least regulating child labor, and they have age minimums, but you still have a lot of concerns about this, right? Because we're seeing children minors, right? Mill workers, they're in factories. We actually still see a fair amount of this today, depending on the industry that we're talking about, but there's a lot of concern about this because these are often unsafe conditions. So Congress, between 1910 and 1918, is trying to get rid of child labor practices. By 1916, they've passed this Keating-Owen Child Labor Law Act, and essentially what they're trying to do is limit and give those age minimums. We don't want actual children, underage individuals, having to work in these scenarios. It comes to the Supreme Court via this case, Hammer v. Dagenhart, where Roland Dagenhart, is working in a textile mill. And his employer pushes back and refuses to let his 14-year-old son, Reuben, work in the same mill. So Roland Dagenhart takes the case to suit. He sues the United States Attorney, W.C. Hammer, and we get this case in court pushing for, well, essentially Congress violates the Commerce Clause. At least that's the argument from Mr. Dagenhart, right? It might also violate the 10th Amendment. It might violate the 5th Amendment if we're thinking about things like due process. But at the heart of it, what the Supreme Court comes back with and says is, yeah, this actually does go beyond what the Commerce Clause would authorize in a standard sense. Go back to the concept of dual federalism. When we talk about that, we often recognize the state has what are called police powers. Police powers aren't just referring to criminal entities or violations of criminal law. Police powers with respect to the state mean we can legislate and regulate things that we think are moral or immoral, such as the use of children in situations where they're engaging in unsafe labor. That really is a dual federalism constraint on the national government. The states have been allocated this power, and it should be respected because that's their frame, that's their space. They get to use that level of power, and attempting to overreach the way Congress did here is actually denying them the right level of authority to govern their own affairs, okay? So yes, it is a violation of the 10th Amendment because this is a power reserved to the states, those police powers. What the justices write in that decision is, the grant of power to Congress over the subject of interstate commerce was to enable it to regulate such commerce and not to give it authority to control the states in their exercise of the police power over local trade and manufacture. The grant of authority over a purely federal matter was not intended to destroy the local power always existing and carefully reserved to the states in the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. So commerce is pushed back on here, right? Congress may want to get at child labor, but you can't do it through the Commerce Clause. That's overstepping your bounds. And then we see everything change. Because in the 1930s, actually late 1920s, early 1930s, the U.S. encounters the Great Depression, a time and period of economic decline that we cannot really replicate today. Folks may have felt like the pandemic was a huge recession, and it was significant, no doubt. But the size and length of the effects of the Great Depression really dwarf what we experienced with the pandemic. We have massive unemployment, we have widespread poverty and homelessness. And what happens here is you get a particularly strong president in Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he is going to push for Congress to take a lot of action with respect to the situation in the country to help rebuild the economy. He's going to have so much power that he's going to be able to threaten the Supreme Court by saying he's going to pack the court with more justices, and we're going to see this immense shift. While we had decisions before the FDR era and the 1930s that point toward a specific division of power, we now have expansion of the power under the Commerce Clause. So our post-depression cases with activities, the justices are going to say, if the activities have an effect on interstate commerce, then the court's going to defer to Congress. They're going to step back and say, okay, that's within your authority. We have two standout cases here, and my favorite is really Wickard v. Filburn. I'm not going to talk so much about NLRB versus Jones, but in Wickard v. Filburn, you have an individual growing wheat, and approximately 12 acres of wheat that he's going to keep for himself and his family. And just by growing that wheat, which could have some hypothetical effect on interstate commerce, they're allowed to regulate that. Congress can step in and impose a penalty on that individual. Pretty expansive power with respect to activities that really, in any fundamentally correct way we would think about, really shouldn't affect interstate commerce because the people are keeping it for themselves and using for their own consumption. All right, let's go to division. Where previously we had topics that were usually reserved for the states, like criminal activity, Congress can jump in now. And we're seeing this much later in 1971, but it's on that same line of expansive Commerce Clause power. In the case of Perez v. United States, we're actually investigating the activities of a loan shark, and he gets charged under Title II of the Consumer Credit Protection Act, which is a federal law. And he pushes back saying, this is criminal activity, this isn't commerce activity or not commercial. And the court says, no, this Consumer Credit Protection Act is fine under the Commerce Clause. And it's okay for this to expand to loan sharks who use extortion to collect payments, right? It doesn't matter that it's organized crime. It can have a substantially adverse effect on interstate commerce. So we're going broad and wide here. It's hard to imagine loan sharking having a huge amount of effect on interstate commerce, but the Supreme Court says, yeah, we can roll with that large logic here. Moving on to that last set of questions about purpose, we also see the elimination of restrictions here. So I've already talked about Perez v. United States, right, where we're getting into criminal and criminal restrictions. We don't care about the purpose of the law, but we have a few other cases that I'm going to highlight very quickly. United States v. Darby and Heart of Atlanta Motel versus United States. The legal issues at the heart of U.S. v. Darby really aren't so far off of what we've already seen with Hammer v. Dagenhart, because this goes back to the Fair Labor Standards Act. It's talking about regulating aspects of employment, minimum wage, how many hours can you work, and child labor. This lumber manufacturer, Darby, he's shipping lumber out of state. He's not necessarily doing anything other than that. They go ahead and arrest him for violating the Fair Labor Standards Act. He's paying his workers less than the minimum wage. He's not paying them for overtime. He isn't keeping employment records. So he's not doing right by the people who are his employees. But does that bring him under the realm of interstate commerce because he's shipping his goods out of state? Well, the court says not to again. Long after the case of Hammer v. Dagenhart, yes, this is fine. This act is a legitimate exercise of Congress's power related to interstate commerce. We're not worried about the purpose being fair labor or appropriate treatment of employees, which wasn't good enough for interstate commerce before. We're going to go with this, saying this is a legitimate exercise of authority. Heart of Atlanta Motel is going to go even further because we're going to be looking actually at civil rights and discrimination. We have Title II of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. You cannot discriminate on race if it's a place of a public accommodation if the operations of that place affect commerce. Here's the tie into the Commerce Clause, right? Heart of Atlanta Motel, located in Atlanta, Georgia, is not going to let Black Americans stay there. So the government stops the motel from discriminating by taking them to court, and we end up with this question: is Title II of the Civil Rights Act going beyond the Commerce Clause power because we're talking about places of public accommodation, like a hotel, and giving them the power to choose their own customers? Supreme Court says unanimously, this extends. It's fine. These are okay enactments of the Commerce Clause because we're talking about some sort of effect on interstate commerce. They go so far as to say the motel is close to interstates and most of its business comes from outside of the state. So they do have an impact on interstate commerce, and that's all that Congress needs to show us. It's a pretty interesting in-depth specifics to the motel itself, but all of these cases together show you that purpose doesn't matter anymore. As long as we've got a reasonable idea of the Commerce Clause and how this is tied into the legal question or the power that Congress is asserting, it's going to be fine. Post-Depression, very much a different philosophy about the Commerce Clause than beforehand. Okay, setting the Commerce Clause aside, let's turn to taxing and spending power as defined in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. This is where we draw our taxing and spending power. What we see with respect to taxing and spending power cases is very much like the Commerce Clause cases. There is one defined trend, pre-Depression, and one very different trend, post-Depression. Rather than tease all of the pre-Depression taxing and spending power cases out, let's focus simply on those that are more recent. That takes us to our layman's terms cases for this week and the ones I want you to delve into with your reading. First among these, South Dakota v. Dole from 1987. This case centers on the issue of legal drinking age. And how much could the federal government do to induce states to make changes to that legal drinking age? The graphic that you see presented on slide 18 was the legal drinking age or the legal age of purchase across the states in the year 1975, when we saw probably the lowest drinking age laws in existence across the United States. You can see any state that is green is listing it as 18. So that's going to be Colorado. That's going to be some states who have a minimum age between 18 and 21. There's some changes there in the law. What are we going between? We have states where the minimum age is 21. The entire West Coast is at that at this time. Whereas right now, we all have a minimum drinking age of 21 across the United States. How did we get so uniform? Well, the simple fact is the United States government said, hey, we will put some money on the table and help you all with your roads in exchange for changing your state laws to increase your minimum drinking age or minimum legal age of purchase of alcohol to 21. South Dakota, who was not super on board with this because they had an age lower than that, pushed back. The legal drinking age in South Dakota in 1984, when this case was initially filed, is 19. So they had allowed those individuals to purchase alcohol. They pushed back because they don't think that this should be something allowed to Congress. They're, again, we're pushing all this back in these cases on the national government's power and authority. And generally that means Congress, because Congress is the lawmaking entity. Did they exceed their powers? And the legal question here brings in even the 21st Amendment, which, as you may know, is the amendment we utilized to throw out prohibition. The 18th Amendment is our alcohol prohibition amendment, overturned by the 21st Amendment, which gets rid of prohibition. The 21st Amendment, by the way, is the only amendment that we have had ratified by state ratifying conventions, and it didn't take long for people to toss out the prohibition era. It took them less than a year to do these different ratifying conventions. Utah, of all states, put us over that line. So we get the 21st Amendment, we get South Dakota v. Dole. When you are reading through this case, focus in particular on the spending power and what is said by the court about the spending power. How is Congress limited with that? How is it not limited with that? Do that little bit of digging in to see where they draw the line there. Remember, for this case and all of the other cases aside from Trump v. Anderson, you only need to read the portions of the case that are included in your textbook. So the reading on South Dakota v. Dole is pages 398 to 400. Just focus in on that bit unless you are doing a layman's terms handout for this case. So remember, we don't need to be reading the full opinion. We're trying to hone in on what the textbook says related to those powers. We're just going to use those snippets unless we have to do the full case for our layman's terms. Next on our list is United States v. Lopez, a case that the decision was issued in 1995, argued in late 1994. This all has to do with the Gun-Free School Zones Act of 1990. Now, the argument related to congressional power here is about the Commerce Clause. So you might be able to, in your head, connect where we're going with this conversation. Guns and the Commerce Clause. The thing you're going to find that's different here than what happens in the post-Depression era is we have a new court. We have different justices, and they're going to take a different approach to the Commerce Clause and the way that they consider it. We are now, at this point in time, sitting with the Rehnquist Court. So Rehnquist is the Chief Justice. We have individuals like Sandra Day O'Connor, Justice Antonin Scalia, Anthony Kennedy, Clarence Thomas. It's a very different makeup of a court than what we saw in between the Depression and, let's say, the 1980s. I want you to be thinking about how this court is significantly different from those, and then how does it apply a different approach to the Commerce Clause. It's pretty straightforward in terms of the explanation of the case, I think. It's a little bit longer in your book, pages 384 to 388. Focus in on those five pages or four pages roughly, and do your best to understand how the Supreme Court is addressing the Commerce Clause in this era. Next case, we are looking at Gonzalez v. Reich. In this case, we are encountering one of our more contemporary issues, medical marijuana and or the legalization of marijuana for use in medical situations. In Gonzalez v. Reich, we are encountering an individual, Angel Reich, who is allowed under state law to have marijuana for medical use. I'm going to stop my case facts discussion there because I want you to kind of dig into it just a little bit more. A quick note, this is going to be a head-to-head contest between states and federal again, because that is what these cases are all about. Where do we draw the line? What is national or federal? What is state? The last of our layman's terms cases is going to be one of the more complex readings you will have to do. It is also one of the lengthier cases in our textbook. I would not fault you for wanting to use outside resources on this one. This is National Federation of Independent Businesses, or NFIB, versus Sibelius. Okay, NFIB versus Sibelius comes down to really what we have embodied as the major fight over the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. The Affordable Care Act is something that is developed in the 2000s, late 2000s, under President Obama. It's put forth, it passes Congress, the executive obviously signs off on it here, and it's going to be challenged not too long after that point in time because there's a lot of pushback on elements of the plan, like the mandate, a mandate for insurance. And if you don't want to buy the insurance, well, then you're going to face a charge, a tax penalty. Is this something Congress can do? Always the question at the end of the day, but with nuanced different details. In your reading, again, take your time with this one. More complex. It's a little bit more nuanced in terms of government power, and the language can be a bit hard to follow at times. But keep with it. Do the best you can to identify what they say about things like taxing power. The last case I have put forth for you to read for this week is quite a different approach to the division between national and state. And it's very recent, as in within the last year, this decision has come down. This is the case of Trump v. Anderson. And I've asked you here to read the full opinion because it is not a terribly lengthy opinion. It's a total of 20 pages in the PDF version. And remember, when they print these out in the PDF version, they have got huge margins on every side of the paper. So really what you're going to be reading is probably close to, I don't know, if you were to single space it on a normal paper, maybe 6 pages, maybe 7, something in that general realm. This is the case about the 14th Amendment and which entity is really responsible for enforcement of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. This takes us away from things like the Commerce Clause or taxing and spending power, but it's a new set of challenges related to the division between federal and state. And for that reason, I wanted to include this case. I didn't just want it for that reason, honestly. I want us to be reading cases that are very recent that give us insight into our current Supreme Court led by Chief Justice John Roberts. And I want us to be looking at the logic and arguments of these justices to get a sense for how a predominantly originalist court approaches the legal questions differently from courts in prior decades, right? The Rehnquist court is different from the Roberts court. They're both led by conservatives, right? There's still generally more conservatives on the court than liberals, although you could say maybe the Rehnquist court had more balance because you had more of a toss-up judge in there. But generally speaking, we're talking about courts that tend to take a more conservative approach to the legal questions and issues that come before it. But how does the Roberts court write its opinions that look different than what you might see in United States v. Lopez or Gonzalez v. Reich? Those types of insights are important for us with respect to understanding the methods of interpretation. What is predominant at one time does not stand forever. Different courts have different dominant approaches, different dominant philosophies, and it will affect the interpretation and application of the constitutional rights and liberties that the government has and that individuals have. What you have in a Warren court is not what you have in a Roberts court. And knowing those differences and understanding how they can affect not only government but our day-to-day lives is quite an important thing, in my personal opinion. Wow, this has been a short podcast episode, extending our conversation on federalism, only about 40 minutes here, so I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up now with a few reminders about upcoming assignments. We have our initial drafts very soon, this upcoming Sunday, so please, if you have any questions or concerns about that, reach out to let me know. Following that, we have peer reviews. I will be posting instructions on how to complete fully remote peer reviews so that you can do that easily and hopefully very effectively. And then November 17th, all of the remaining layman's terms handouts are due. That is the last of the layman's terms because we are very much close to the end of the semester. Our final new material will be covered in the week of November 18th. So get through that, go have a fabulous Thanksgiving, come back, do some review and revisiting of the material before we hit the final exam in December. Okay, thank you so much for taking the time to tune in and listen to this episode. I look forward to connecting with you again soon with more on federalism.